All right. How
good
you doing?
Morning.
Good morning. How's life?
Life's great.
Excellent, man. So, wanted to come and chat with you about, well, a couple of things, right? We created a thread on Channel 9, wanted to get a sense of, hey, you've been playing with the beta, what do you think? What do you want to tell Dean? And so in an old school way, here we are, camera, questions that you haven't seen yet.
Right.
Yes, don't look.
Okay.
So first of all, I wanted to ask you about, how's the beta gone? Like numbers of downloads, if you want to talk about that, or you know, like feedback, etc. What's going on?
I think the beta is going super well. I think we've had over 13 million downloads,
nice.
And the number keeps going up,
which is
great. The feedback for the most part has been positive. Mm-hmm. By definition, a beta is around going, yeah, but tell me what you hate. Right? Tell me what's not working
exactly.
For you.
Okay.
And we have lots of channels that we're listening to. You know, there's Windows Error Reporting, which is my favorite because that's automated. We understand. And it's all negative feedback, right? You never get Windows Error Reporting that says, life's great. You only get the, oh, here's a crash, right? So there's that. Connect. Microsoft Connect has been great in terms of people submitting, I found this issue, I have this challenge. There have been forums that have been great. I go up on Twitter at least a couple of times a day and see what people are posting and commenting on. And, you know, of course, we're very fixated mm-hmm. on the negative feedback here in the engineering hallway.
Sure.
And there's another building down that way where the people are very fixated on the positive feedback.
The marketing people.
I don't
or
use that
word.
Or
the advertising. You don't use that word. Okay, fair enough. So today you also released, I mean, we're filming this today. This will be released probably today or maybe tomorrow. But PP7,
yep.
Platform PP7. Interesting things going on there. Tell me about it.
Well, the comment that we got around Platform PP7 yesterday when we told a couple of close friends about it
mm-hmm.
was, wow, this is totally not what I was expecting to have this phone call about because it hasn't been about 8 weeks.
Sure.
You know, we had said that we'd do regular platform preview builds leading up to the beta.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we shipped the beta back on September 15th. And they're like, and you just did one about 2.5 weeks ago. What's going on? We said, well, you know, we'd made enough progress in the last 2.5 weeks that we wanted to share it and get some more developer feedback.
Excellent.
The bulk of that progress was on the JavaScript engine. And what we've done basically since PDC is we'd gone through and looked even harder at real-world patterns in JavaScript.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ray tracing, not that much of a real-world pattern. Fast Fourier transforms, yeah, it kind of depends what sites. You probably go to sites where there are a lot of FFTs. The people I'm related to, not
understood.
As much.
Well, your brother's a physicist, so...
Nuclear cardiologist.
Oh, forgive me.
And I'm proud.
Excellent.
So we looked at all these real-world patterns, and the folks who work on the JavaScript engine did a lot of fine-tuning for these patterns. And, you know, there are computer science textbooks
mm-hmm.
That are filled with great examples of how do you work on an interpreter, how do you make it world-class, mm-hmm. and what's the standard of care for
yes.
For a great JavaScript engine. And there were a lot of optimizations they did. They applied them. And so we said, hey, I know it's only been 2.5 weeks, but we should put this out.
Perfect.
And we put it out. Now, what's interesting around Platform Preview 7 in particular is there are some new test drive samples. And, you know, we think that the real-world patterns that you get in a web page are always more interesting than the patterns you'll see in a microbenchmark. Right? Those microbenchmarks are really overly narrow and focused.
Mm-hmm.
And so the test drive samples for this time... There's one called Galactic, which is just awesome. In fact, there's something I forgot to put in the blog post.
Uh-oh.
That I should just mention here.
Do it.
Then the Niners will get better. For folks who are in the better hemisphere, like the folks around New Zealand and Australia.
Okay.
Right, as the planets are moving around,
uh-huh.
there is a secret hotkey that you can press and it flips the whole model upside down.
Really?
So that Australia, New Zealand, and all the other things that are south of the equator are actually on top
nice.
Of the model.
Wow.
Secret call out because we love the southern hemisphere at least as much as we love the northern hemisphere. You know, the test drive samples are great because they're real-world patterns. And whether you're running Galactic or you're running a tag cloud example that goes through, you know, we grabbed the text of several Shakespeare plays.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice big corpus of text. And we do tag clouds. We calculate them on the fly
nice.
For these Shakespeare plays. What's super interesting is you can run the I9 beta, the original I9 beta from 9.15, and Platform Preview 7,
mm-hmm.
November 17, and basically see 8 weeks of progress.
Awesome.
And see how much faster the Sudoku solver, Shakespeare's Tag Cloud, and Galactic runs across them. Now, the things that, well, all the delta was in the JavaScript engine,
mm-hmm.
right? You really see the holistic approach, right? Because it's not like, you know, the web is just JavaScript.
Agreed.
Or the web is just graphics, or the web is just DOM, or just CSS. It really takes all these things coming together. And IE9 looks at the performance holistically. And you can see the test drive samples, right? I went on a length because it really is, hey, the big surprise is that it was only 2.5 weeks. The non-surprise is that there are some great test drive samples. Now, the thing that I actually got a couple of text messages this morning from friends about were just like, wow, interesting WebKit SunSpider results.
Yes.
Why did you hide those at the bottom of the blog post?
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, let's talk about that. I mean, it's rather impressive news. I mean, I'll just go out and say it. I mean, you are now, IE9 PP7 is now the fastest browser at the SunSpider test.
Right.
I mean, that's actually very, very interesting.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because there's been so much attention put on this one micro benchmark. And so, you know, on the one hand, you know, yay.
Yes.
Right? It's great. You know, the team saw this and saw that people were interested in it. I think it's a good time to step back and say, well, what have we been saying all along,
mm-hmm.
and are we saying anything differently today? And you know, whether you look at our IE8 result or you look at our IE9 Preview 7 result, our point of view is the same.
Mm-hmm.
Micro benchmarks are at best not useful.
Agreed.
And at worst, well, there are all sorts of things that you can be negative about. And so the outcome on WebKit SunSpider, I think, it is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's not... the thing is that WebKit SunSpider and the results there are really a side effect. They're not the main focus of the work that we're doing. Mm-hmm. The main focus is the real-world web.
Understood. And clearly, you guys are computing that very rapidly. And again, I want to just quickly state that the JavaScript kind of machine world is CPU bound, and a lot of work that you've done is GPU bound. So the wonderful work in graphics, I wanted to kind of you talked about holistic you know, performance systems. All of the renderable tags and CSS is targeted at the GPU. Is this correct?
Right. And so when you look at web pages, right, they need all the systems. Because at the end of the day, you want to see the web page.
Yes.
Right, so the GPU is unbelievably helpful on that front.
Mm-hmm.
And JavaScript is super important in order to essentially calculate. A lot of web pages, they are really calculated.
Mm-hmm.
You can find a lot of web pages where the only thing that occurs between the HTML tags,
mm-hmm.
well, it's just about blank. Right, and the whole page is essentially calculated in the result of JavaScript. Now, the JavaScript stuff really is very, well, it can be very CPU intensive.
Mm-hmm.
And using the GPU helps the rest of the page. In terms of being CPU bound,
mm-hmm.
and essentially that means, you know, for the folks who are new to Channel 9 or not really genuine Channel 9ers,
mm-hmm.
that it's the gating factor. It's the thing in shortest supply.
Mm-hmm.
Even then, there's some really what I'll call out there subtleties.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, what's the cache like on your CPU? And what's the on button? And so there are all these, you can always dig deeper. And
mm-hmm.
I'm sure you could find, you know, some single core ancient chip where another script engine would do a better job.
Mm.
But then you look at what we've done with JavaScript in terms of using the whole PC, and you know, I'm hard pressed to find a machine for sale in the last couple of years
mm-hmm.
that only had one core. And so essentially when you buy a computer now, you're really buying multiple computers.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear about like a Core 2 Duo, well, you got more than one core. And the question is, what's your computer doing? Like, you bought all this computer. Is your browser using all of it or just some of it? Well, what IE does is it runs the web page in one of these cores, and it kicks off JavaScript running in the other core. So you're using more of the PC. And that's a great example of using all the CPU. Because it's interesting. You said CPU bound.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. It's not even CPU bound. You're kind of core bound.
Sure.
Why aren't you using the other ones?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, everyone's got an excuse why they don't use the other ones. I don't really get off on the excuse thing. So we're using more than one core.
Yeah.
And the other guys might say, but what if you only have one core? Okay, if you only have one core, only use one core.
Mm-hmm.
But what if I want to run a browser in my toaster oven? okay, well, go write a browser optimized for the toaster oven. We're going to go write a browser optimized for the PCs that people are running.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So now I want to jump into a couple topics. This I want to ask you this.
Yeah.
And then we'll get into the Niners questions. So certainly always.
God, there are a lot of pages of questions there.
Well, actually, these are just two copies.
Oh, cool.
One of which you didn't get, and people need to understand that.
Great.
So that was my original intention, but you turned it down because you're old school, and I appreciate that. HTML5, man.
I mean, we're for it.
We're for it. But what does it all mean, Dean? I mean, why are we? What's going on here? What is the big deal?
You know, the big deal is we've all been going at the web long enough that we understand that we can build real world class experiences on the web. And you go back and you look at what web pages used to look like, and they really just used to look like pages. And they've been getting richer and richer and more capable. And, you know, there's that whole Web 2.0 thing.
Yep.
Right? And it's great. It's almost like we jumped from Web 2.0 to Web 5.0, right, with HTML5. And really the whole point of HTML5 is, what are all the technologies, whether they're in the actual HTML5 spec or in other specs, like ECMAScript 5 or JavaScript is how we usually refer to it. You know, if you set aside which specification things are in, right, you basically realize there's a set of technologies that are coming online that, one, enable the web to deliver amazing experiences, and two, enable developers to use the same markup as they run those experiences everywhere. That's unbelievably important. And then you go out and say, well, what do we really need? Well, we need good specifications. Got it. And we want that markup to run the same across browsers, so that developers, like a lot of the folks who watch Channel 9, can write it and expect it to run in multiple places. It's not like when you were an old-school Windows developer, you'd have to compile once for a Pentium and compile again for, oh, it's a P2. Oh, and now it's, you know, it's Core 2 Duo. I need to keep recompiling. Well, people don't want to have to rewrite their websites.
Yep.
So you have, is the technology coming online? Can I use the same markup? Then you go, am I getting the most out of the device it's running on? And so we think hardware acceleration, using the most that the device can offer, is an important part of delivering amazing HTML5. Frankly, HTML5 needs amazing test suites to deliver on that same markup. And you know, when I talk with the folks who work on WebKit, or we have conversations at one of the W3C meetings, with folks who work on other browsers and other browsing engines, it's really clear that, you know, we've gotten the specifications up to here, and the test suites need to climb up and meet those as well. So these are all aspects that make HTML5 world class. And then a lot of people get all caught up in, well, is it HTML5 or HTML5? Do you mean this specification, or do you mean this specification and the canvas specification? And what about SVG, which is somewhere else? And I've got a half-written blog post, and this I'll pre-announce a blog post.
Excellent.
That. There's this blog post that basically goes through and says, look, here are all the standards that folks have ever considered to be part of greater HTML5. I grew up in New York. And it's great, because when you say New York, well, do you mean New York City?
Yep.
Or do you mean greater metropolitan New York? Are you including New Jersey?
No.
Because there are Thank you. Old school. And so, you know, there are parts of New Jersey that are like, there are all these people who just, you know, come across from New Jersey, right? There are people who are so hardcore, they think Manhattan is New York, right? Which, yeah, I was born in the Bronx.
Hey.
Don't really agree with that.
Sure.
And so it's interesting to talk about HTML5 and really understand greater HTML5 and what the greater metropolitan region looks like.
Excellent.
And so I'll get the post out. I'll bounce it off you, then we can maybe talk again.
Sounds awesome.
With the camera. Okay, but there are more questions.
There are.
Now,
listen,
the
beautiful thing about that is that it jumps nicely into a question by C. Kurt, who's a Niner. All of these guys are. I'll definitely call out their names.
Yeah.
How do you personally, Dean, feel about the way the HTML5 standard is progressing? It's taking such a long time to form. It's slowing down the evolution of the uniform internet and causing more and more fragmentation between browsers. Is it not?
Okay, so the question is, how do I feel about HTML5 velocity?
Yeah, exactly. So
how is HTML5 converging? I feel pretty good. I feel pretty good in terms of, you know, where we are in terms of getting the dates right and having all these dates converge sooner rather than later.
Sure.
We really want it to be sooner, and it's sooner with quality. And part of that is focusing on what's under our control, mm-hmm. and by our I mean the working group. How are we engaging? Like, are we engaging constructively in the working group aliases, or are people sniping? Mm. Are we providing more tests, or are we members of the working group complaining about stuff that's going on? I think that converging HTML5 quickly and with quality is totally under our control. Mm. Now, personally, I think that the co-chairs have really hard jobs, and they're doing an amazing job keeping things orderly. And, you know, the co-chairs represent Apple and WebKit and IBM, and you've got people contributing from not just some of the bigger companies, but also what I'll call private citizens on the web. We have invited experts. I think that it's really important to keep in mind on the topic of HTML5 convergence that, you know, we're all very aligned around these same goals.
Sure.
Delivering these great experiences.
Excellent. Now, the next question from Bass, B-A-S.
Yes.
Long time Niner. Of course, most of these are.
Yeah.
What if the HTML5 standard changes, is finalized within IE9's lifetime mm-hmm. and before IE10 mm-hmm. Is out? What's going to happen? Are you going to patch IE9? So, in other words, I mean, the question's
yeah,
pretty
yeah,
clear.
Yeah. It makes sense. So, this is where... So the first thing you need to do is call it to a blog post, because there's a really well-written blog post
okay.
that went out in the last day or two around vendor prefixes.
All right.
So I just, like, went deep down into a kind of inside baseball, basement kind of reference there.
Okay.
And to say, if you ask that question, you really hear about the vendor prefix post. I'm going to suggest you read that. Now let me step back and say, broadly, how does this work?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have product life cycles. We have product lifetimes. Right, so IE9 comes out on this date, and you know, there's another release here, and you know, for what it's worth, even IE8 has changed in the time that it's been out. You know, every other month, there's an update to IE8. Every other month, there's been an update to IE7. So the products do evolve.
Mm.
The question is really, from a developer point of view, when I write code, what code do I write, and how does that work out?
Mm.
And so. You take the HTML5 standard, and let's say it goes through and it releases and it hits candidate recommendation and last call, and finally it is a capital R recommendation.
Okay.
You know, even after it becomes a capital R recommendation, it's going to keep changing because there's going to be errata.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And for all these things, you see that it keeps changing. SVG. SVG 10, 11, 12. 12, second release. And so there's this ongoing evolution as we figure out what's going on. CSS 2.1 that on the one hand really should be done, right? And on the other hand, what we're finding as we write the tests is that we still have what I'll call interesting, say, 1 to 2% case around places where the specification isn't quite as clear or unambiguous as it could be. And we have browsers doing different things. Okay, so what's with this long build-up, Dean? Why can't you just answer the
yes.
question? Well, you're a developer. You write a web page. You wrote the web page. Today is Wednesday, and it works.
Yes.
And it works on IE9, and it works on this browser and that browser and the other browser. Now the standard changes. Okay.
Yep.
Is your web page going to change? How much do you want your web page to change? And so the point is that your web page assumes that the browsers behave in a certain way. And so they should. Now there's more writing that happens in committee, outside of committee.
Sure.
And then browsers start changing their behavior. How do we negotiate as a community, mm-hmm. browser manufacturer, site developer, mm-hmm. what happens when the standard changes and the browsers change and the site changes? Like, how much do you want to have to change your sites every day, every time the standard changes? So basically, IE9 releases and it becomes a platform, and it's solid, and it doesn't change its behavior.
Good.
Right? It doesn't, because if we kept changing the behavior of the browser mm-hmm. at that cadence, all these sites, oh, the site worked Tuesday, well, it doesn't work today.
Mm-hmm.
That would be unfortunate.
Now, are there scenarios where, let's assume that in the standard, somebody had a light bulb moment
mm-hmm.
and said, wait a minute. We have to add this feature that enables JavaScript
right.
to do X, Y, and Z.
Right.
It's critical. And so everyone's like ratifies it and goes, you're right.
Right.
But you'd have to say we can't break what's already out there.
Right. That's a great question. Actually, you know, I was wrong. Let me tell you exactly when we're going to break something.
Okay.
Because we do break stuff.
Sure.
I should be very explicit when we break stuff. We break compatibility and behavior for security vulnerabilities all the time.
Okay.
So there's a security issue. Ready? I want to break that security vulnerability. And so the behavior of the browser changes to make sure that people stay safe.
Perfect.
There are examples outside of raw security. You can just broaden that out to trust,
mm-hmm.
whether it's reliability. Hey, when I hand a browser this pattern, it hangs. I don't want it to hang. So we'll break behavior when it comes to trust issues. But outside of that, even if all the world's people joined hand and said, oh, we need to change this behavior right now, mm-hmm. you still need to lean back and go, wow, I have a CD. I have this old kids game. And it runs, and it runs in a browser, and it assumes this kind of behavior. You need to keep that compatibility.
Sure.
Right? Or, you know, NASA.gov has got some really nice old site that assumes some interesting behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
What should we do? The worst thing that we can do is have site developers get on a treadmill that's not under their control. There's a standard under construction. I won't mention its name right now because it's kind of interesting. And there is a case where another browser implemented an early version of the spec, and developers wrote code to that browser using that technology. Then the browser released the next version and changed it all. And so a site developer who wrote code over here, that code didn't work anymore. Then they could rewrite the code to work on the next rel of this browser. And then, yay, they got to redo all their work, and the code worked. And in the time it took them to rev this browser and change all the site code, ready, the standard changed. So now this browser works with this code, but the standard completely changed around. And so now, like, everybody loses.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa, if I'm this browser vendor, do I keep all the old code around? And in some ways, this is like a huge IE6 moment. This is huge IE6. Like, the IE6 pattern is there's a browser, and it does stuff this way. And then sites need to go and perform acts to work with the browser that way.
Mm-hmm.
And now here's the next browser. And you know, putting site developers in the middle of this crunch and churn
mm-hmm.
is really, really unfortunate. So let's get back to Vass's question.
Yeah.
Vass, Bah, he could be French.
She could
be French.
I think actually he is from Belgium. I might be wrong, Boss. I'm sorry.
Okay, we'll figure that out.
I think he is.
Right, okay. And so, like, are you going to go back and re-record all the Channel 9 videos where you ever called this person Bass?
No, we'll call him Bob.
Okay.
I like that.
And so to answer the question is, look, the standard might be fixed in time, but as the product ships, developers expect it to behave a certain way.
Yes.
If Intel could go out and redo some of the microcode, right, that's sitting there, you know, on the one hand, maybe it would be great, but on the other hand, you go and you launch World of Warcraft and it suddenly doesn't work.
Yeah.
Could be an issue for you.
Absolutely.
Okay, sorry. We should go.
No worries. This is great. So now we're going to move on to Josh Ross.
Okay.
And this is about telemetry. So Windows 7 had a tremendous amount of telemetry captured from beta users, and that mm-hmm. information was immensely valuable. Talked a lot about that on Channel 9.
Yeah.
Are you doing the same thing for, you know, IE9?
Absolutely. So we've got a bunch of data. Part of that data... there are several flavors of the data, but I want to talk about how we're using that data. When we release the IE9 RC, the release candidate, there are going to be a bunch of changes versus the beta. Right now, some of those changes came from bugs that folks like Niners logged in Connect.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those changes also came from the telemetry. What's great about the telemetry is that in some ways it's authentic.
Mm.
It's faithful representation because it's what people actually did and used, not what they said they did, not what they said they used. And so we're seeing really interesting patterns, for example, in the user experience. Well, how are people using things? And we're using that telemetry data to inform the changes we make. I think that in the absence of data, you're just rearranging chairs,
mm.
right? Then it's just fashion.
Sure.
Right. When we use that telemetry data to make sure the changes we make reflect how people actually use the product.
Excellent.
So I promise to share even more of the telemetry data. We shared a lot at the beta launch.
Okay.
In fact, if you watch that video from San Francisco,
mm.
there's a chunk maybe about 5 minutes into the Here's the IE9 beta where we do comparisons of IE8 telemetry, like how many people use the favorites bar in what way, with Windows 7 telemetry. And we have some really exciting data. I just saw some of it yesterday, but I'm not gonna let it out of the bag.
No worries. Thank you. So, and this is great, because this leads nicely into Exoterra, who's one of our more technical niners.
Great name.
Really into programming. How do you measure Internet Explorer stability and when it's ready for RTM? So you mentioned just a second ago, we talked about, how do you know when the bread is baked?
Right.
How do you really understand that?
Right. So the specific question was around reliability?
Yes.
It was reliability.
Reliability.
Okay, so this is great. So very precise.
And stability.
And stability. Good subtle distinction there. So I'll say that ultimately what really matters is how reliable and how stable is the browser on your machine for the sites that you visit. That's the ultimate measure for each individual human being who's actually running it.
Sure.
What we do is we look at a lot of data. We have data coming related to telemetry from around the web. Mm-hmm. Hey, real-world people, when their browsers crash, because browsers crash, applications crash, etc., what are they crashing in? Are they crashing in Core IE or are they crashing in Atoms? Then we have a lot of intense lab work that goes on. There's a great video, Charles, you might want to link to it.
Okay.
I think that some of the folks from PC Magazine walked around and did a video from looking at Jason Upton's labs
here
on the I-team, and you just see row after row of machines. There's a lot of automation that says, how long can we effectively run a stress test?
Yep.
It's like when you do material science and you're trying to figure out, there's an iron beam, how much load can it carry? Right, and so we essentially do that with browsers. Like, how long can we run it before we get a failure? How intensely can we run it? Right, so it's like testing battery life
in
that way. So we do a lot of testing like that, and we look at the results. We compare them to what we see in other browsers. We compare them to previous releases, and we have in our internal dashboard of how it works. We have reliability measures. Same way that we have compatibility measures, standards compliance measures, security measures. I'll go back to the comment I made around trust. Like, even before I'd heard that question, I said, look, we'll break compatibility with security vulnerabilities and privacy issues and reliability issues.
Sure.
Right? Like, oh, there's a way of crashing the browser or a way of hanging the browser. Hey, we want to eliminate that. You ask, how can we tell? And the answer is we look at all the ways that it fails, and we try to figure out marginal gain and marginal cost. And then we realize that we're on an every other month update cycle. At the latest every other month update cycle, we've often gone out of band. And that gets driven a lot by telemetry as well.
Excellent. Now, of course, Exoterra...
You're trying to figure out if I can ever give a short answer. I'm
no, actually,
answer.
I think this is great, because they deserve good answers from you, right?
Okay.
And you know, they spent time asking...
Oh, then we should have had Giorgio here. The last time I was doing it, you had Giorgio. Giorgio gives good answers.
Giorgio gives great answers. So, the question that he extends it to the notion of... And he learned a lot about this on Channel 9, because of how we covered sort of deep Windows 7.
Yeah.
Was the granularity of telemetry is pretty amazing. Like, how long did it take from this click to this action happen?
Right.
And then they measure that and send it off.
Yeah.
Do you guys do that around latency as well? Like, how long did it take this code to execute? How long did it take this site to launch?
Yeah.
Et cetera.
So we do that for the IE code.
Okay.
What I think is even more exciting is that site developers can do that for your code. So it was initially called the Web Timing Spec, and I think the name's changed a little bit. There's a blog post in the last couple of weeks. I linked to it from the Platform Preview 7 blog post. There's work in the W3C, in the web standards body, and that work includes folks from Google as well as Mozilla and other organizations. And that enables website developers to put in their own telemetry and to measure how long their pages are taking to get from... point to point to point in the web page.
Okay.
We actually have test drive samples, so you can see this in action, and you can essentially check or uncheck, do I want this enormous image to load? And you can see the web page drawing a graph of how long it's taking. The web page is describing how long the web page is taking.
Excellent.
It's kind of cool. So sites can do that telemetry. In our telemetry, we also look at patterns. We look at the sequences, like, okay, somebody, of all the people who did new tab page, who clicked and said new tab page, First, what percentage of everyone running IE did that? Did they click or did they do Control T? We can break that up. Mm-hmm. Then we can then look at the next action. We can say, after they did new tab page, did they type in the address bar? Or did they click away and do something else? Mm. And so we have these amazing chains, and we have a lot of information. And one of the most exciting things that folks on the team do is look for patterns. And so they get to be detectives.
Excellent.
Not play detective. They actually get to be detectives and look for patterns. And there's a pattern. You know, it's too historical. It goes back to the 90s and Word. It has nothing to do with IE. I'll save that for another interview. I promise.
So we're going to now jump down into a different rabbit hole.
Okay.
This guy, I think, I'm pretty sure is from Belgium. This is Zippy V.
Okay.
Which is, he's a longtime Niner.
How do you know that Zippy's a he?
Because I can sense that. But it's a good question. I'm almost positive it is because his real... We know a lot of these people's real names.
Okay.
For example, Zippy V won about 4 years ago, won a contest for... We had a developer contest on Channel 9, and he won. So we know his real name.
Great.
But that's a great question.
Clear,
I don't know. One of the things that we haven't really talked about in our many of our conversations around IE9 is the notion of the complexity of the plug-in model. The add-on model.
Yeah.
It's still Calm. Calm is ugly. Calm is actually beautiful. I take that back. Calm actually implements dependent types, which is something we talked about with Eric Meyer a while ago.
Right.
So my point that I wanted to make is, and this is Zippy V's point,
right?
Will we be able to write JavaScript or .NET plugins for IE?
Mm-hmm.
We need an easier way to interact deeply with the browser, but writing native plugins is too difficult. So native, the Calm plugins, is too difficult. And accelerators can't go deep enough. So he's asking, are we going to simplify it? What's going on?
So, you know, I promised a short answer at some point.
This will be one.
So maybe this can start as a short answer and then I can mess it up. So for IE9 in the IE9 time frame, no.
Okay.
Longer term, you know, and the question totally makes sense. There are web patterns that... a lot of people know and understand and are comfortable with HTML, CSS, and script. And the question is, how can we best use web patterns to extend the browser? I think that the poster child example of that, which is actually far more powerful than anyone gives it credit for on the web today, is bookmarklets. I think that using JavaScript, you can essentially put something on the favorites bar, and you run a little JavaScript, and it modifies the page. It's user-initiated, and so most of these things actually look and feel and run like an add-on.
Mm.
And what's great is that they run cross-browser. And so you can go and you can find a bookmarklet. Some people call them favelets, but I think most people just call them bookmarklets. And you can find some great ones, and the great thing is that it goes back to same markup. The bookmarklets can then run in IE as well as other browsers. And they can do some amazing things. And there are bookmarklets. We should just do a blog post with some of our favorites and then ask the community. And actually, it would be a great Channel 9 thread to start. What's your favorite bookmarklet?
Okay.
It turns out that bookmarklets can end up doing some super, super deep things because bookmarklets can then go and in turn invoke some server-side stuff as well and go back and forth and work with a page. And the best thing about bookmarklets is that their impact on reliability, stability, and performance are known. They don't have an impact. One of the tough patterns that you see is how add-ons, no matter how they're written, whether they're written using web patterns or COM patterns, how they impact browser reliability and performance. You know, we've blogged about some of the issues that we've seen and the add-on performance protection functionality that the IE9 beta has for finding slow add-ons.
Mm-hmm.
Other browsers have some interesting patterns as well, that when you install an add-on outside of the browser and then you start that browser up, other browsers have these big modal prompts that come up and say, whoa, did you really want this?
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that this can affect your performance. And it's interesting, you know, I talked briefly about compatibility. Site compatibility is a big deal. When you start using web patterns to write add-ons. Mm-hmm. And then the browser changes how the web patterns work. You end up breaking add-ons very easily. And so it's always exciting to watch the tail of add-ons actually become compatible when other browsers rev. And it's interesting to listen to the chatter around, oh, I want to upgrade to the latest, but I really care a lot about this add-on, and I'm waiting for the add-on to update because I don't want to change, I don't want to upgrade my browser until this one works. And so there's a lot. I tried so hard to make that short.
But that's great. I mean, in some sense, if sane markup and HTML5 vision ever, I mean, if it becomes real,
yeah.
becomes true,
yeah.
the notion of writing something in a completely foreign context to mm-hmm. extend that which is not there and what's presented to you, and that's why
yeah.
you write that, may be unnecessary. So it's an yeah. interesting, I mean, it's not saying that it will be unnecessary, but chances are you might not have to do that if you can get what you need to get done in the standards and sane markup
yeah.
way.
Yeah, you know, it's a really good point. A lot of the add-ons date back to when pages were pages. And the more that sites become rich and interactive and much more like applications,
mm-hmm.
The odder it is to have these add-ons in some ways. Right? And that's I think that's a tension, a space tension point, mm-hmm. that it would be great to hear from Niners. It's
Absolutely.
Like, hey, I have this add-on, but then every time this website updates, I need to change this. Like, I think of the number of interesting YouTube downloader extensions there are.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in this ongoing cat, mouse, chicken, egg scenario. Every time the site changes, they need to update. Every time the site changes, they need to update. And that's an interesting challenge.
Excellent. So I'm going to get to these last
yeah.
four questions. So this is from Nasmus 1992.
Okay.
Are you anxious to see if Mozilla actually sends in a cake to the IE team when IE9 ships?
This came up in a meeting yesterday. Somebody on the IE test team said, hey, is anyone ever going to send us a cake? we did get a cake
okay.
from a development team inside of Microsoft.
Excellent.
From basically our cousins, right? Because they were very happy with some of the functionality we added. They were trying to be nice, so they sent over a cake. I have a picture of the cake.
Perfect.
No one else has sent a cake. I'm not holding my breath, but you know, we're in Building 50, and
yeah.
folks who want to should feel free to send stuff in.
Excellent. One more question from Nasmus is: do you plan to have? This is actually a good question because we don't ever really.
Yeah, the other one's good
talk
too.
Yeah. Very good. Why don't we just aim for a 100 on the ACID 3 test? Do you plan mm-hmm. to do that?
Right. The ACID tests, since there are multiple of them.
Sure.
It's kind of like the WebKit SunSpider conversation we had,
mm-hmm.
right? In terms of what do real world sites use and do, and what do the standards really do, and then what happens on this test.
Mm-hmm.
The remaining 5 points. Involve a couple of technologies, SVG fonts, and SMILE, capital, all caps, S-M-I-L, SMILE. And it's interesting because those are really in transition. SVG fonts have really, what's the right way of saying this? It seems like we're all doing WOF. This is all caps, W-O-F-F.
Okay.
As the web font solution. And some Mozilla guys, I think it started with Mozilla, they had some ideas, and now all the browsers seem to have really good support for WAF fonts, not SVG fonts. SVG fonts do some interesting things. It's kind of on the side. So WAF seems to have won out there.
Okay.
SMILE animations for SVG are kind of interesting. At the most recent W3C, again, standards body, at their meeting, which is called a TPAC, for a technical plenary something or other, recently got together, and it's great because folks from different working groups got together and said, wow, this whole SMILE thing isn't really working out. We need to make sense of the CSS animations and transitions and the SMILE animations and how does it work with SVG.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically there's some cleanup that needs to happen. And since those standards are clearly in transition, supporting them is kind of a dead end for
okay.
developers because these aren't patterns that developers are familiar with today, and they're clearly not gonna they're not growth
mm-hmm.
not gonna go, and the standards body and the people really are cleaning it up, so supporting them doesn't make sense. It's kind of it's an interesting timely thing. I was listening to the news, and they keep talking about the lame duck session in the U.S. Congress. And it's an odd term, lame duck. Lame duck essentially means the people know that they're going to leave.
Yep.
And they only have a fixed amount of time that they still have power, or they're still in authority.
Okay.
And it's interesting. I'd never really thought about lame duck standards, but in some ways, maybe these are lame duck standards because we know that the next wave of them are coming, and we'd rather do our investment with the ones that have a future.
Absolutely.
Than the ones that are dead-ended.
Excellent. So Typhoon 87 asks, okay. And this is a great question, will platform previews continue after RTW release so we can see where you are heading for IE10 for the next release?
Okay.
You seem to be about a six-week or so window, certainly less than PP7.
Right. Hey, so the question is, are we going to do IE10 platform previews?
Exciting one.
Sounds like a good idea. So, you know, we'll finish I9.
Okay.
And then we'll get going on that.
Perfect. And his second question is somewhat related. I mean, clearly, any possibility of smaller update windows between releases? So will we see a IE 9.1 or 9.5 that is smaller in scope but quicker to market?
So narrower, faster update windows of the browser. You know, I think that that's really what the platform previews are for. I think that, so calling out to Typhoon 87, I think one thing you'll notice is that you have... different populations want updates at different timelines. Mm. So, you know, there's order of magnitude, say, hundreds, I'll just leave it as hundreds. So order of magnitude 10 to the 2 want, a nightly build, right? And then you come over here to platform previews and say, hey, if you go out to about approximately 8-week window, you get order of magnitude 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 7. Right, that's a big shift. Mm-hmm. So I get that there's a small number of people who want super rapid updating, and for the most part, that's really for experimenting, and that's exactly what the platform previews are about. And we've shown that we can do them in a 2.5-week timeline. We can do them in a approximately 8-week timeline. I think the most important thing for any update is that it's actually meaningful and shows meaningful progress. We could show meaningful progress on some real-world script patterns in about 2.5 weeks, so we did that. Mm-hmm. The thing is, when we're talking amongst ourselves as technology enthusiasts, we like having more frequent updates because we can try stuff out and give each other feedback and try and work on it. Mm-hmm. I think that when we work on things for customers, when we work on things for humans, we need to operate with what they have. And so expecting everyone to be as enthusiastic as we are and update as quickly as we enjoy updating, I don't think that's a realistic, useful pattern for those guys.
Sure. But, I mean, it's awesome that you're going to continue on with these developer previews.
Hey, you know, I thought it was a great idea. I got to go talk with the team and figure out how that will work out. I think it's a really good idea.
Excellent. Yeah.
Okay.
So U.S. Archer asks, what improvements have been made around touch support? Is the UI fully baked in this beta in relation to that?
Okay, so touch support, of course, because everything is complex when it comes to engineering. Touch support has two flavors. There's the touch support in the IE frame and user interface, and there's touch support in the web pages. Touch support is what it is. Mm-hmm. It's pretty good,
okay.
Right? It's completely derived from what we had on Windows 7. I haven't heard much negative feedback about it, and for the most part, I only seek out negative feedback. You could argue that's how I was raised, but that's a whole other conversation outside of Channel 9. Archer, you know, my request is, tell me what issues you're having with the touch support, because then we can figure out whether we need to make code changes or improve our documentation, because that's really the important part.
Excellent. And another question from U.S. Archer is, what is the state of web slices? Remember we did a bunch of that stuff for IE8. Something you still encourage site developers to implement for IE9 specifically, mm-hmm. It would be really useful if we could preview these from the pinned site icon.
Ooh. Wow. That's a great feature idea. I had not thought of that. So just to roll back. So web slices in IE9. It's a great... here's the short answer. They totally work. They continue to totally work. And sites that have web slices, they'll totally work in IE9. Users who love web slices, they'll continue to work in IE9. We saw some healthy adoption of those. And so, you know, I encourage sites that that think they're useful to continue building them. And you know, in terms of the idea of having web slices interact with pin sites, wow, that's another great conversation I'm going to have as soon as the camera's off. That's a really neat idea.
Nice job, U.S. Archer. All right, the last question I think is actually great. This is why it's the last question.
A train leaves Chicago.
A train leaves Chicago at 7 a.m. We're going to do a logic test. I mean, you're a mathematician. You'll have no problem.
Right.
But so this is cool. I mean, does the IE team still feel... Look, do you still feel like you're playing catch-up? This is from Andy C.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you feel that you're now... That IE is once again driving or forging the path forward? I mean, I know that... With all the same markup talk, and we all want to be one big happy family, and make it life easier for developers. In some sense, you guys are sort of pushing the limits of general purpose computing in a browser, essentially enabling us to write general purpose GPU in HTML and CSS and JavaScript. So, talk to me about answer that question for Andy C, please.
So you know, Andy, in some ways, I think you answered your own question because you said, "Hey, IE guys, you're driving." And you're pushing the limits on how my HTML5 sites can use everything that's available on the PC and use all the hardware and use the GPU and use multi-core.
Mm-hmm.
And the important thing is that, you know, that's what you're experiencing. How I feel personally, or how people on the team here in this hallway feel personally, is completely unimportant compared to how developers are experiencing this. I think anyone who goes and downloads Platform Preview 7 and runs it and runs the test drive samples and compares the test drive samples in Platform Preview 7 versus the beta from 8 weeks ago and runs, you know, one of the, let's see, it's Firefox 4 Beta 8 preview. You can get that preview now.
Okay.
Or, you know, one of the early Chrome drops. And you go and you run the test drive samples in the different browsers and you say, wow, when I'm running a real web page that uses real patterns, right, that uses JavaScript and the DOM, that does graphics, you know, and some you know, user interaction, and that mixes and matches the, you know, 10 or 11 or 12, depending on how you want to count them, browser subsystems, I think you'll see a completely different level of performance that comes from the work we've been doing in IE9. When you combine that with the experience, when you combine that with how we help users maintain trust, right? Oh, this add-on is slow, or oh, this add-on is crashing, or oh, this site over here is hanging or crashing, and wow, that site is now isolated with great performance. Right, and then you combine that with the user experience, right? Like I look across my my Windows 7 taskbar now, and it's changed a lot of my experience of the web. I get up in the morning, and I can click on XKCD, right, and read the cartoon. And you know, every morning I can. It was better before. Like I guess something's gone on in his life, and he's actually not updating right now. But it was right there. Or, you know, I can go and I can click on Twitter. I have one click access to these websites. And when you look at the combination of experience and trust and the work in the platform, I think it's very easy to try to go Boolean and say, are you leading or are you catching up? And you know, I don't know if that's the most constructive way to look at it. And I think that Andy answered his own question probably in the second part of that question with, well, here's how you see it. You see amazing performance, Andy, with the builds that we're providing and the real-world samples. And, you know, that makes my Wednesday great.
Excellent.
Okay.
Hey, thank you for spending some time with us. I know you're super busy.
Okay.
And you answered all the questions that I sort of decided to scrub out and pull out. Some of them were probably a little less useful or just sort of criticisms, but you like negative things, so I should have left some more negative things in there.
We clearly love that negative feedback. Hey, so just a quick call to the Channel Niners, right?
Please.
So please download Platform Preview 7. We appreciate all the feedback. Positive and negative, right? But, you know, again, we can't fix the positive feedback with the product, so we tend to filter that way. Keep the questions coming, for what it's worth, and, you know, happy, you know, basically specifically two things. One, are there bookmarklets that you really like? Because that can help inform one of the posts that we do.
Okay.
And the other is, in addition to questions, are there broad topics? Because, you know, this is a big couch here.
Yes.
And, you know, happy to have other folks come and answer questions. You know, Jason Weber's got a video up now.
Yes, he does.
On performance. I think that's a great video. If there are specific things around, hey, I'm trying to figure out how to do this in CSS, or I'm trying to figure out how to do that in SVG, or, you know, we've gotten a couple of questions like, when do I use Canvas and when do I use SVG? Any questions that Niners have, we'd love to hear and we'd love to engage more.
Excellent. Okay.
Thanks again, Charles.
Thank you.
Okay.
Cheers.
All right, yes. So I walked away from Charles.
Yes.
And it was just hey, let's just go and see if you left your car keys or anything in my office, because I want to make sure that you're okay. And I come in, I find this envelope on my desk. And this is just a great example of, hey, do you guys get feedback and do you listen to it?
Yes.
And so it's great because somebody was in the mailroom, saw this letter to me. It comes from Warren, New Jersey.
Excellent.
Which I think of as part of the greater New York area.
You do.
Right, just for what it's worth. I try to be open-minded.
Okay.
And so this is a letter. And so we take our feedback seriously, whether it comes from automated telemetry or people going on Connect or people submitting stuff at Channel 9 or the U.S. Postal Service.
Excellent.
We take the feedback seriously. And
we're going to open
really
it live.
Well sealed. Yeah. Wow, this is some seriously impressive sealing going on.
Those New Jersey people, man.
Okay, and so I'm going to go like this.
I think it's just awesome that people still write letters.
And, okay, and, you know.
Is there a check in there?
Making sure we have all the feedback. We have all the feedback. And it's great. So, like, we have two pages of feedback. And also handwritten feedback.
Nice.
And the subject is product feature request in IE9. And we're going to go read this, and we're going to take it down the hall. And this is a great example of, no, really, we do want the feedback.
Excellent.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Cheers.